Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Community is one of those words that gets thrown around a lot. At times of crisis, during election seasons, whenever we want to code something as true and authentic. Most of us want to be rooted in community. Many of us consider it essential, a place where we can feel safe and be seen and find joy that can be elusive in a society that is often unkind to us because of who we are or where we're from. But the thing about community is that word is so misleading. It's kind of like what they say about love, you know, that community, it should be a verb. It's a thing we do together. And sometimes that thing is really hard work. In this episode, we have two dispatches from communities that have been forced to do intense work lately in order to deal with the awful consequences of the COVID-19 outbreak and to face old, hidden demons that the Black Lives Matter protests have forced out into the open. I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future. In our first dispatch, reporter Jenny Casas has been following a very painful self-reckoning in a Mexican neighborhood in Chicago, a place called Little Village. As protests against police violence took over the streets of Chicago, Jenny met two women, two community organizers, who saw something deeply wrong within their community in Little Village. And they've begun to confront it. And just a note that some of the sounds you'll hear in this story are disturbing.
So let's just start from the beginning, May 31st. Mm-hmm. What was happening that weekend?
There was a huge protest in downtown Chicago that drew thousands of people. So we all went together in caravan to downtown.
Laura Ramirez joined the protests when they began almost 2 weeks ago.
When we get there, most folks got out of their cars and joined the protest that was already ongoing.
What is this?
During that day, around 5 or 6 p.m., I started to notice that the feel of the protest went from just being a march to then people started saying that they started looting around the Magnificent Mile, which is one of the most expensive areas to shop in the entire city. I got home at around 8. There started to be all these news around cop cars being burned, around people looting, the police being violent with folks. I mean, it just became a very violent scene.
In response to that property damage, Chicago's mayor cut off access to downtown. More police were sent in and a curfew was set. Public transit was shut down. So the next day, Sunday, protesters had to take their demonstrations north, south, and out west.
So that's when the violence started to move into our neighborhood.
Laura lives in Little Village, which is on the southwest side of the city. And it's famous all over the Midwest for its big Latino population. It has all these vibrant businesses. And so that night, she starts seeing all these posts on social media with all these people out on the main commercial strip.
All right, so we are here on 26th and Spalding, listening to some freestyle, waiting for all these so-called looters to pass by.
We heard reports that they were, and this is, I quote what I heard from folks, which is Black young people were coming in to loot the stores. So the Mexican owners decided to go out and protect their stores.
Man, there's 157,000 Mexicans on 26th Street. Stop believing the hype. Ain't no looters coming to 26th Street right now. No looters coming to Little Village. I promise you.
There were reports of people standing outside of their stores with guns.
And it's happening in predominantly Latino neighborhoods across the city. And these are non-Black Latinos.
We're protecting our own, baby.
As that Sunday wore on, the few people who were just standing outside of businesses bloated into large crowds, with people making clear they wanted outsiders to stay out. People are recording the confrontations in the street.
So basically, the violence that had started as a protection for the businesses actually spilled over into attacking Black folks in our community.
Laura starts seeing videos in her feed of groups of guys lining the street armed with bats and bricks.
They feel like Black people are in their area to tear up their community and loot in their area.
There are personal videos from Black Chicagoans warning other Black Chicagoans to stay out of Little Village and all Latino neighborhoods.
Stay out of that area. Don't go to no gas stations over there. If you coming, take a whole nother route.
They shooting you and they hitting your cars with bats and bricks.
Snatching people out of their cars, pulling guns out on them and everything. If you are Black, don't go in no Mexican neighborhood.
So Laura goes out to the street to see for herself.
I went to the street where I usually have breakfast. There's like a little restaurant there, and I parked, and that's when I witnessed the ramming and the bricking. Mm. It was all coming at once, and as I walked towards this, it was down the street, a street that I walked down all the time, I start seeing all the police, and it literally looked like a police occupation. But also some of us who tried to go down to 26th Street to figure out what was happening and offer support to any Black folks that were there, we were ran out of our own streets by the gang members and threatened if we didn't stop supporting them.
Laura is getting all these texts checking in on her. She's checking in on other people. And one of these text threads is a group chat with other Little Village organizers, a group called El Foro del Pueblo, the People's Forum.
And I'm just thinking, what in the world is going on? How is this happening?
Esmeralda Hernandez was in that text thread.
I remember there was a text that said, no, this, we have to do something because my friend is trying to get home. And he said to me that he could ride in the trunk of her car if she would take him home.
It felt like a cold bucket of water. And in that moment, I really felt a lot of responsibility, right? Because living in this neighborhood, being here for this long and witnessing the level of hatred and ignorance against Black folks, we weren't all on the side of justice and we weren't all on the side of Black lives. And that to me was heartbreaking, specifically as a mother of children who are mixed, you know, Black and Mexican. So I specifically knew my children couldn't be here. So my next step was to get my daughter out of the neighborhood and take her to the suburbs where she could be safe. And in that realization, right, that my children were not safe in my own home and that it was our own people who were threatening to hurt them.
Laura gets her daughter out of the neighborhood. The group creates a phone tree. They coordinate rides for anyone who needs to get out. They bring groceries and medicine to people who are too afraid to leave their homes.
So that was pretty much Monday. And then on Tuesday morning, I showed up at this meeting. There were about 30 people there. It was about pretty even between Black folks and Mexican folks. And we sat down and we talked about what needed to be done.
And this meeting is special. It's with organizers from North Lawndale, the neighborhood next to Little Village. North Lawndale is a historically Black community. It's where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. lived when he was organizing in Chicago.
In my experience in Chicago, being here for over 25 years, this is the only time that I have seen Brown and Black folks come together to talk about racism, not to talk about anything else, but racism and police brutality.
Chicago's notorious segregation is at the root of so many of these tensions. So even though North Lawndale and Little Village share a border, they are no exception. These are two communities that do not collaborate often.
I mean, I've been living in Little Village off and on for 25 years, and I have never had a Black neighbor. I think it's only been in the past year that Black folks have been allowed to rent. And I know for a fact that people who rent homes don't want to rent to Black folks in Mexican neighborhoods, specifically in Little Village.
Laura can see that anti-Black sentiment in so many places. in public, in social scenes, and in her own family.
One personal narrative that I have, and I'm sure this exists in every Mexican family, is that when my daughter was born, one of my family members came into the delivery room and said, "Oh, she's black, but she's pretty." And it's those little things. My father literally disowned me. He stopped talking to me for 12 years after I had children with a black man. There's these larger systems that are at play right now that are intoxicating us, that are poisoning us, that are taking money away from our neighborhoods, that are literally creating these problems. And instead of really having a strategy to go after that, we go after each other.
So now Laura is sitting in a room with Chicagoans from two neighborhoods that don't usually meet, and they decide together that Little Village should have its own march in defense of black lives.
There was a conversation around, is it safe for black to invite black folks, right? This should be a unity march. We want this to be headed by black folks. And they asked us not to. They said, you know, unless you can secure their safety 100%, it's irresponsible of you to invite black folks to Little Village.
El Foro members plan to hold the rally the next Wednesday on the main commercial strip, under the neighborhood's iconic arch that reads, "Bienvenidos a Little Village."
Like, this does not belong to the police. This does not belong to the gangs. This belongs to the community.
It's still scary, though.
You know, the night before, there was already a press conference that some of the gang intervention organizations were going to have. However, it was so unsafe that even they canceled. And for them to cancel is like, oh, no, like, it's really serious. And they literally put the word out there, do not leave your home.
It's all Zoom meetings and nobody's sleeping, really. You know, we're all texting each other, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. It's like, wait a minute. Didn't we all say goodnight like 3 hours ago? I'm going to be really honest. Everybody was scared.
At 10 a.m., under the arch, about 100 people gathered. A local group of danzantes performed a ritual. Participants burned sage and copal before the group marched into the street.
What I am saying is we have to look at where we're at. We are at the break or make point. Either we're going to get together or we're going to destroy each other. And we cannot let them win. But we are here to say enough is enough! Enough is enough! Enough is enough! We will not, and I want you to repeat after me, we will not allow them to divide us.
We will not allow them to divide us.
We will not allow them to win.
We will not allow them to win.
Black lives matter!
Black.
We did reach out to, you know, some black youth who had wanted to participate, and we said, if it's safe, would you want to come down and speak? And they did.
We are both subject to the denial of our basic rights on U.S. soil, the land which belongs to your indigenous ancestors and which my ancestors were forced to build America by the colonizers. We are stronger together than we are divided. Situations like these only make us closer. Why? Because we family.
That day of the march, the local gangs called a truce. The shooting calmed down, and Laura got her daughter back home from the suburbs.
She came back home, and I'm like, oh, do you know, how are you? She's like, I want to go to my dad's, right? So she doesn't want to be here. My son doesn't either, which is incredibly difficult for me as their mom. And I don't blame them. Even if we made the unity march, even if we write this Black Lives Matter things on the walls, like, the damage is done. We have shown black folks that their lives are in danger. We have shown that we're easily manipulated by the police and the system to turn against each other. So I think, if anything, my shame for what our community has done does not end with the Unity March. This is something that we're going to have to deeply heal and uproot for years.
Laura says the real work has yet to happen.
When people ask me, what can I do? It's talk to your people. Right now, it's grab your people, talk to your people, and join the movement, right? Like, if Black folks are asking us to go out there in solidarity to march, then go out there in solidarity to march. If you're being asked to boycott something, do it. If you're being asked to not say certain words, do it. If you're being asked to sit down and witness, then do that. You know, I think right now it's about taking Black leadership and just following that. At the end of the day, what is more dangerous to a system of white supremacy than Black and brown people uniting? I can't think of anything, right?
Coming up, we turn to another neighborhood where the community is confronting hard truths. In this case, the reality of just how rapidly the bottom can fall out.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know, like there are urgent things happening in the world, but all you hear is noise. That's where What Next comes in, a daily news show we love from Slate. They tell you the stories you haven't heard before or a different side to the stories you thought you already knew. Join host Mary Harris every day as she cuts through the noise so that together we can all figure out what next. Follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
In our second dispatch this episode, we turn to a community here in New York City, where COVID-19 has hit harder than almost any other place on the globe so far. As of today, as I record this, nearly 22,000 people have died in New York City. And if you look at a map of infections here, you'll see them densely clustered inside a group of neighborhoods in Queens, Jackson Heights, Elmhurst, and Corona. And here's the thing about those places. To a lot of New Yorkers, they kind of represent the best of this city. Queens is often ranked as the most diverse county in the country, and these neighborhoods are the most diverse in Queens. But over the past few months, they have had to fend for themselves against this virus and against the economic devastation that has come along with it. Reporter Anjali Kamat has been following that harrowing effort.
I moved to Jackson Heights 6 months ago when the world was a different place. I had long been drawn to this bustling part of New York City, thick with the enticing smells of street food from Mexico, Nepal, Colombia, Ecuador, Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, the sounds of Bollywood songs and the Muslim call to prayer competing with cumbia, all of this drowned out by the 7 train thundering above Roosevelt Avenue. Like so many other immigrants from South Asia and Latin America, Jackson Heights felt like the closest thing to home. Then, in the middle of March, the virus hit, and the streets fell quiet. All you could hear was the sirens, and the deadly toll of the crisis in central Queens began to emerge.
Elmhurst Hospital is the epicenter of the COVID crisis that we're going through. Elmhurst Hospital is filled to the brim. There are over 500 beds here, and all of those beds are filled at this point.
That's my council member Danny Drum speaking to the Washington Post. Even though I live just a few blocks from Elmhurst Hospital, from the confines of my apartment, it was hard to get a real sense of just how bad things were.
Tell me your full name.
It's Nilbia.
I started to call some of the people who would know.
I think that back then we imagined that this would become crazy, but we didn't know how tragic it would become.
Nilbia Coyote is the director of training at NICE, New Immigrant Community Empowerment, which works with over 7,000 day laborers. They're mostly construction workers from Latin America, and a lot of them are undocumented. She began to hear that people in the community were getting sick and dying. These were essential workers.
These people were still working. They lack a lot of information.
She told me about the case of Julian Hernandez. He lived in Flatbush, Brooklyn, and for 18 years he had worked 12-hour shifts 6 days a week at Mundo Supermarket.
The employers didn't care if he was feeling symptoms or if he was sick. He had to come. And he didn't know that even if he was undocumented, he had rights.
Hola, Sebastián. Me llamo Angeli.
I spoke to his brother, Sebastián Hernández. He told me Julián fell seriously ill in the middle of March with COVID-19 symptoms, but wasn't allowed to take any sick leave.
Mal de los pulmones, dice, y porque trabajo mucho, él me dijo.
When he finally got a few hours off on April 16th, Sebastián took him to see a doctor who told him his lungs were inflamed and he needed to rest.
Sí, él regresó a trabajar.
But Julián felt pressured to return to work. 3 days later, he collapsed at the cash register. That night, he died at Kings County Hospital. He had all the symptoms of COVID-19, but the doctors aren't sure if that's what killed him. Sebastián wasn't able to see his brother's body or afford a burial.
Muy, muy, mucho dolor porque...
Sebastián wants Mundo Supermarket to compensate Julián's wife and daughter in Mexico for the 18 years he worked there. I wish he had gotten just 2 weeks off, he said. He might still be alive.
Cristian Calvario Arenas. Juan Pablo Castro.
In late April, NICE held an online memorial for the coronavirus-related deaths in the Latinx community in New York City. City estimates put that number at about 6,500 people.
A lot of people are dying at home. They were never able to go to the hospitals we have seen people who didn't get a test. We have seen people who waited for hours for an ambulance. And even after passing, they waited for hours to get the body removed or taken to a funeral home.
As the death toll from the coronavirus continued to mount, the mass unemployment created the next crisis, hunger. The need for food was so overwhelming that NICE started a food distribution center right near the 74th Street Roosevelt Avenue subway stop.
I'm sure you have seen the lines when it's something blocks. People are desperate for work.
I went to visit last month just before it opened.
¿Puedo entrar?
Sí, sí.
¿Qué es la comida?
La comida, pues, es arroz, también es pasta, es pollo, pescado, y un poquito de cerdo.
Juan Jose, who's a trainer at NICE, described what was in each bag, enough to feed a family of 4 or 5 people. They had 100 bags that day. Soon, dozens of people started lining up, and 5 out-of-work construction workers started taking down their information and passing out bags of food.
Como yo no puedo apoyar con dinero, pues yo quisiera dar algo de mi tiempo. Es lo que me apasiona en algo servir a la comunidad.
We saw needs rapidly change from I need a job to I need food and I can't pay rent and I'm being evicted within like a few days.
Sarah Feldman is the worker rights manager at NICE. I reached her over a Zoom call.
Because our community can't count on the safety net, and a lot of our folks work kind of week to week and might not have a lot of savings. We know that however much food we distribute, it's never going to be enough for everyone. And if we post pictures, you know, on Facebook or something, we get 1,000 calls the next day saying, you know, how do I sign up? Where do I get food?
NICE isn't the only organization trying to address the hunger crisis. There's the city providing free meals at public schools and large charity groups running food pantries. But it's still not enough. And that's where something new has happened. Dozens of mutual aid groups have sprung up in communities across the city, and they're doing something crucial, delivering bags of groceries and home-cooked food to people within their networks who are too sick or too old to leave home and stand in line for food. Meet Kazi Fauzia.
So first thing I found, a lot of COVID positive family don't have access to go outside, bring food, nobody to care.
Kazi is the organizing director at Drum. They sees Rising Up and Moving, a group that organizes low-wage South Asian and Indo-Caribbean immigrants. Kazi's in her late 40s and has a battery of her own health issues that puts her in a high-risk category. But that hasn't stopped her.
This is the time to work. This is the time to support each other.
Kazi started with six families who needed medical attention and food. She began her own mutual aid group. With help from Queens Mutual Aid and Bangladeshi and Muslim groups who help with fundraising and food distribution, Kazi has become the central node in feeding over 200 families across the city. She's the person connecting people who are hungry with people who want to help.
I just say, okay, how many people? What is the condition? What type of food do you need? That's it.
New York City has not released ethnic-level data on COVID fatalities, but community leaders estimate that at least 250 Bangladeshis have died. Kazi blames the cramped housing conditions that most families live in. She told me about one of the first calls she got.
What's her name? Her name is Charmin.
Charmin and her husband, Mohammed Atikur Rahman, both fell ill in the middle of March. Her husband had been an Uber driver until he got sick and had to give up his car. Charmin called 911 but was told to stay home and monitor symptoms. When they went to CityMD, her husband tested positive and they were given the same advice. A few days later, she was getting sicker and her husband could barely breathe. They called 911 again and an ambulance took him to Elmhurst Hospital. She said she was so sick and scared that day, she was convinced her husband would die at the hospital and she would die at home. And her biggest fear was that her children, just 1.5 and 8, would be orphaned. That's when she called Kazi.
Really painful for me also when someone say, probably I'm also dying. I'm not going to see my husband ever. You have to take care of my kids, Kazi.
Charmin was asking someone she'd never met before to take care of her children. That's how desperate she was. Kazi told me she's called Charmin every day since, getting her out of bed and telling her not to give up. Even today, Charmin is relying on Kazi for food and baby supplies, as her husband is still too sick to work or keep up with the rent. That rent is over $1,800 a month. That's a lot of money to come up with for a family that's been sick and out of work for 3 months. Multiply this across the city, where hundreds of thousands of people have lost their jobs. In this community, there's a growing fear of mass evictions. Fahad Ahmed is a longtime organizer and executive director of Drum. He's watching a community barely holding on.
Whenever these sorts of crises happen, historically we've seen, it just exposes so many contradictions in a way that it is impossible for things to be able to go back to the way that they were. Some new sort of balance has to emerge. But the direction of that balance is still up in the air.
These days, the soundtrack of Jackson Heights has changed again. The streets are filled with people and the sounds of their voices, channeling their grief and fear into calls for justice. The grim realities of loss and hunger and unemployment haven't gone away. But there's a real feeling that a breaking point has been reached, and that change is possible and necessary.
The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. This episode was reported and produced by Jenny Casas and Anjali Comet. It was edited by Marianne McCune and Karen Frillman, who is also our executive producer. Mike Cruz did the mixing. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Christopher Wirth, and Marilyn Williams, with help this week from Michelle Harris and Kim Nowaki. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Please do keep in touch. You can follow me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. Thank you for listening, and as always, take care of yourselves.
The
The United States of Anxiety's health coverage is supported in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health that ensures everyone in America has a fair and just opportunity for health and well-being. More at rwjf.org.